Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Good evening. My name is William Morse, and I'm your host for Interchange. I'm pleased to have with us tonight a very special guest, Barbara Cope. Barbara is a former vice chancellor of Indiana University at Northwest in Gary, Indiana. She's also served as the dean of students at Indiana University Northwest in Gary, and has also served as a special services programs director there. Barbara, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, it's very nice to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Before we start, just on a casual note, you know, last night in southern Indiana, we were plagued with a large storm, hurricane, tornado-type weather. What are things like up in Gary?
Oh, today has been cool but lovely.
Very good.
Sunny, but you know, you think, oh, I could go out in short sleeves. No, get a sweater. Because the lake is our, you know, our air conditioner here. And sometimes it looks like it's hot, but because the lake water hasn't warmed up, the air doesn't warm up. And so it's been kind of cool today.
Well, sometimes northern Indiana, of course, and southern Indiana can seem like two different states. And
absolutely.
I think historically, even the southern part of Indiana has been called the 14th state of the Confederacy. But we don't want to tell our friends. No, we won't go there. Barbara, you know, you and I have talked, and I know you have been involved in education in Indiana for over 50 years.
Right, absolutely.
And what we wanted to talk about, at least to use as our launching point, was to just, well, first of all, let's just talk about some of the things you have done. I tried to give an introduction of your background, but maybe you can tell us a little bit more about your history, your personal history in education in the state of Indiana.
Okay, and I'll try to do that and not even be boring. It won't take forever. I found out when I was getting ready to retire in 1998, and I thought about my past and what I had done, and I realized I changed jobs every 10 years. I really didn't intend to. I don't know how it happened, but that's what I did. When I started teaching after having graduated from Indiana State,
when it was Indiana State Teachers College.
And drama and language arts classes in the Gary Community School. That was my first choice of a place where I wanted to teach. Unfortunately, I was rejected. I was not hired my first year. And so I went off to Kansas City, Kansas, and I taught there. And what is the interesting thing about that is I was there in 1954. So if you have any thoughts or any interest in history, you might remember that in 1954 in Kansas City, Kansas, that's where
Brown versus Board of Education.
Brown versus the state of the Board of Education. And so that went on while I was there. So did I buy papers and read seriously everything? No, I was totally unaware of what was going on. It once in a while they'd say something, wow, what is all that? Oh, they're trying to desegregate and blah, blah. And so later on I realized that was an opportunity for me to have lived this and really engulfed myself in it, but I did not. Later on I realized that would have been a great thing to have done.
Absolutely.
But I stayed in Kansas for 1 year, and for one reason. Now, you would like to hear me say something about,
yes.
Oh, Indiana. I wanted to come back to Indiana because blah, blah. No. In Kansas City, Kansas, female teachers could not marry. And that was just enough to turn me off right there. Not that I had anybody I was going to marry, but I was hoping that might happen. So I left there after my first year and luckily was hired in Gary and have never regretted it. I taught the Gary system, as probably most of your listeners know, was quite famous back in the 40s, 50s, and even in the 60s, in that they had this very special program which they called Work-Study Play, and it was developed by William Wirt, who was a superintendent of schools for quite a number of years, and it was primarily developed to help immigrant children coming in from the Balkan countries and coming here to work in the steel mills. And, of course, these people were uneducated. They did not have many opportunities to learn another language and that sort of thing. And so these schools were set up primarily for them. And it was a wonderful program. I'm not going to get into details of it, but it was a marvelous program that served this area very well for many years. The thing I loved about it was that I got to work with small children in arts and in drama, and they were such wonderful children to work with. I can never forget my first years when I was working with second, third, and fourth graders in what we called auditorium, and every child had to be in a program at least twice every year, and so it was just fun. It was like I couldn't believe I was being paid to do it.
And this is called Work, Study, Play?
The person whom I eventually married was also teaching in that same area, and so you know how those things go. But anyway, we did get married finally. And I was so happy teaching this. But later on, we had a child, and of course I was on maternity leave, and we didn't automatically get hired back. When I came back to school, I could not get my old job back, which broke my heart, but I was hired to work at a middle school, teaching drama and speech, and those. I didn't think I would like it, but as it turned out, it was really my place of preference. I would have loved to have just stayed there and taught there until I retired. Of course, everybody had to get a master's degree of some kind in those days in order to complete their tenure. And I had such a marvelous set of young people that I taught, but so many of them had problems, as teenagers often do, as minorities and as people who don't have enough money to do everything. They have problems that rear up often, and they need help. They need people to help them learn how to problem solve. And I thought, maybe I'll get my master's in counseling and guidance, even though I don't want to be a counselor. I just want to be better prepared to help those children in my classes to deal with situations they face and to make good decisions in their lives.
Right.
So I did. I went to Roosevelt University, and I got my master's in counseling and guidance. In 1967, I was as happy as a clam, ready to come back to school after I had received my degree. In June, I was ready to come back and start another year, give plays, and do all the things I love to do. Fate stepped in, and the teacher, one of the counselors, became ill, and quite ill, as a matter of fact, had to have surgery, and she really never was able to return to the class, to the counseling office. So my principal looked around and said, well, we've got to get a counselor who could do this. So I said, well, Barbara just got her. Well, I'm this type of person. When someone mentions a new thing that I've never done before, I might say yes just because I want to see what it's like. Well, Barbara, would you like to be a counselor? I said, ooh, that sounds kind of interesting. Have my little office by myself and da-da. And so I said yes. And that ended my career as a teacher. After that, I was a counselor in the middle school. In 1970, my husband and I, our children, we moved to Michigan to live with his mother. I was a counselor there in high school, but the country life did not suit us, so we moved back to Gary. By this time, my husband was working at Indiana University Northwest.
So your husband was the first one to go to Indiana University Northwest?
Yes.
Before you go on, let me...
When we came back, he came back as chair of communications and fine arts.
I see. Before you go on,
department, because at communications, every student has to take communications, so it was a very large department. And he liked that very much. He gave plays and musicals every summer, and so it was his cup of tea. I didn't know what I would do. Since I didn't have a terminal degree, I wasn't going to be a professor, certainly. But the dean of students said, there is a program here called Special Services, it came out of the Higher Education Act of 1968. So, and when he told it to me, it sounded just like what I always wanted to do, work with students who had talent and had ability but did not have a chance. And I was going to be able to help these people who didn't get into college get in, blah, blah. And that's what I did. Loved that. And I stayed in that job until Director of Special Services for about 10 years.
Well, let me ask a question on this because it sounds like you had some tremendous opportunities to see various aspects of education in Indiana. Over that time that you have been involved in education in Indiana, what are some of the changes, though, for better or for worse, that you have seen in education in Indiana?
Well, one of the greatest changes, I guess, from my perspective, other people might see it differently, but as an African-American, this is one that impacted our system and that we watched happen but were powerless to really help it happen in a way we might, in the way teachers might think it should happen, in the way principals, it happened through upper echelon, and that is the integration and desegregation of the schools. It did happen, but it didn't happen in a pretty manner. It was every year we bus some children from the school where I taught, Pulaski, out to one of those schools that had been predominantly white. But the big thing was the busing. The bus, who's going to drive the bus, where are we going to take the kids, which schools will we take them from? And there's always some underlying question about, are we just taking the best kids from the black schools and putting them in the white schools, and why would we do that? And how do we welcome these children when we move them? And those things were not done in the best manner, I have to say. I don't know citywide everything good and everything bad that went on. Some things I'm sure were done well. But I have heard many stories, ugly things that happened, not only to children but to students. That should not have happened. All it would have taken was, you know, some orientation, some preparation of both teachers and students and all, even janitors and cafeteria workers, of how are we going to treat these children when they're out of their neighborhoods, feeling a little like foreigners, and not being welcomed in a way that we would like always to see children welcomed. So that, you know, it's things like that.
Were you familiar?
I don't know about in the classrooms. I wasn't in the classroom, but I know. Here's an illustration. This is just an illustration. Now, I don't mean this is going to describe the whole experience, but this is true, and I know it's true, and other people know about this too. Lou Wallace is a school in Glen Park. It had always been a white school, and one of the ones that they certainly began the integration, and many of the kids in the school where I had taught went to there. Well, I heard this from the teacher that to whom it happened. He taught biology, and he was teaching in his classroom one day, and a teacher who had been in that school, a white teacher, came in his room. And he was teaching, so he was finishing his thought, and the children suddenly became very, very nervous, and he couldn't understand why. And the teacher that had come in was looking a little strange and kind of laughing. And what had happened was she had put a snake on his arm, and he didn't know it was up on his shoulder. And he didn't know it. And, of course, everybody else thought, well, now, that was, he was not only a man, but a science teacher. And if they had done that to me, I'd still be in the insane asylum because I hate snakes, and I would be just, I would have gone nuts, you know. But it was an ugly thing for anybody to do to another person, I thought. And it certainly not anything that furthered a friendship or camaraderie or even education. And it was things like this that happened. Another person whose mother was one of the people who integrated the staff of matrons, the janitorial staff, said that every day a group of girls would come and taunt her and talk about Aunt Jemima and laugh and, you know, just try to see how miserable they could make her. She said, but she was an adult and she needed her job. She had children and needed her job, and so she just ignored it as best she could and went on about it. But it was things like this that should have been actually anticipated and planned for, that I felt we missed the boat there, and so therefore we never really accomplished what you would call desegregation or integration. What we really encouraged was white flight, and it took place in a great number around that time. So I'm just saying, you know, I think that anytime you're going to make such a horrendous change in your school system as we did during that time, we had elected a black mayor, so quite naturally there was a lot of changes going on citywide. We could have done a thing with the schools that would have helped that whole situation and possibly changed the direction of Gary even then, you know, but we chose not to.
Barbara, one of the things that, you know, when people today look back to those days after Brown versus Board of Education and all of the things that happened in the 60s, they would say, well, we've come a long way since that time. Some people would say, well, is the glass half empty or half full? And I'd like to ask you, what do you think, looking back over that time? Is it half empty or half full? We've got a couple minutes before we need to take our first break, but could you begin to address that question?
Well, I can only attempt to address it from my own perspective because I really, you know, we used to talk about this. This topic was always prevalent, but not to me anymore. My life has changed. So, you know, since we recently had an election, we've had some conversations. But so far as I'm concerned, Gary's whole persona has changed to such a degree that that's a hard question for me to answer. We still have many white people living in this area, not just in Miller, although Miller does have quite a few white residents, but all over the city. You see it anytime you go through a neighborhood, you will see that. Now, what we don't see is a large number of children going to the schools. Many of them do go to work. Emerson, a few who live out on the far west side go to West Side High School. But beyond that, very few. Most of those children either attend Catholic schools or they go someplace else, go to Porter County, Portage, or someplace like that. So we have very little mixing of races. We do have some Hispanic students, and so there just is not the opportunity to do what could have been done earlier.
Barbara, in a recent conversation you and I had, you mentioned, you were telling me about how you had participated in starting a charter school in Gary. And what we want to do when we come back for our second segment is let's talk about your charter school, why you started it, and how it's doing. Okay?
All right. Listen, before we leave, I want to say I didn't start it, but I do work with it, and I'll be happy to talk about it.
Very good. My name is William Morris, and this is Interchange, and we'll be back in a minute. My name is William Morris, and you're with Interchange. Welcome back. We're speaking with Barbara Cope. Barbara is the retired vice chancellor of Indiana University Northwest in Gary, way up north, where she also served as dean of students and longtime program director of special services programs. And Barbara, we had talked about this charter school, and I know charter schools around the state are very controversial in many ways. There's some good, there's some bad. It's sort of, some people might separate, might say it separates the haves from the have-nots. Some people say it creates sort of like classes in the quality of educational services received. And I know you've had some experience with charter schools up in Gary. Could you talk about that a little bit, please?
Yes. And the reason that I am involved with the charter school is for the very reason that you mentioned, that some people seem to think this is an elitist type of thing to do, send your child to a charter school. The reason I wanted to become involved with this school was for the particular type of emphasis they have on the children they want to attract, and which they do attract. As a matter of fact, I work with the KIPP, what is now known as the KIPP Charter School, KIPP Lead, in other words, KIPP Leadership.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know about the KIPP schools and the philosophy, but
no, please
they do
tell
have
us.
A little different philosophy than many other, some of the other charter schools. And I was very curious about that, wanted to see a little bit more. I became friends with a young lady who was the founder of the charter school, the KIPP school here in Gary, and she asked if I would serve on the board, and I did. I have been for a little over a year now. I guess maybe about 2 years now. As with everything else, isn't that things are not always what they seem. It's not a panacea, Lord knows. If they're going to make charter schools something that's really going to be progressive and good and correct some of the things that we haven't done in the other regular schools, we're going to have to do better. Because I realize one of the things that charter schools lack, not in people who have, not that they don't have the skills to be good teachers and good administrators, they do. I've worked some, a little bit with Thea Bowman also, and I've seen some wonderful teachers in that school. And other things that they have done very, very well, as we all know, we're proud of them because they also won that wonderful basketball tourney last year. But there are other things that they can't do as much of,
such
simply
as?
Because they are isolated from the regular, what do I want to say, the way that we run the schools, the things that we can depend upon the infrastructure taken care of. For instance, some of the schools have no counselor. So if they don't have a counselor, then that means the teachers or the some administrator or whomever has to do the counseling. And the counseling, you might say, well, so what is that? That's just telling the kids what courses they're going to be in or this or that. It's not. There's a lot more to counseling than that, especially if you have a child with special counseling needs. And so what we do is we just have to do without it, or we have to farm it out, hire somebody to take care of those. And a nurse, you know, if you don't have a nurse right there on site, I mean, that's dangerous too. So there are a lot of things that need to happen if we're serious about it. Maybe we're not. Maybe we're going to do this and let it die out and blah blah. If that's the case, we'll just wait. But
do you think that the governor and assistant to education Tony Bennett, do you think that they are serious about charter schools?
I can't tell. They're serious about using it as an illustration to show that the regular schools are not doing what they feel they should be doing. That's what I see. I don't see them, They have made statements that, oh, charter schools this, charter schools that. But when I hear what they talk about, the substance to me does not prove what they are trying to say. I think they need to dig a little deeper about the needs of charter schools. If they want them to succeed, they're going to have to do some different things. I went to a conference that the KIPP schools had, a national conference. It was very interesting. And one thing that I'm really glad I got a chance to do, and one thing I learned there was this is not the only model that there is. I think it was Pittsburgh that and Texas, Houston maybe, where I think the KIPP school was actually initiated. When they saw the type of progress the children made under this school, the school system embraced it immediately. So they took them into the school system.
They took the KIPP system and then employed that in the public school system.
That's right, and used part of it for the regular schools. You know, they interacted with it. So that's something that I think, you know, would be a hopeful sign. Because then some of those things that I was talking about, the charter schools lack, such as these specialists, ear people who help children who
your
have
counselor or your nurse.
Special ed is a big situation. We have a terrific. I can't even tell you what that problem is, but it is a problem that interferes with the success that the school should have if we because we have such a small number of students, and yet we have special students there. It causes our numbers to look odd, you know, sometimes not what they really should, because we have to service these students too.
Are charter schools appropriate, or are charter schools ready to handle special needs students at this time?
Not totally. They can handle special education students, but it still is going to skew some of their, some of their watermarks that they're trying to make. It's going to make it look as though they are not as successful as they are.
I see.
I can't go into that whole thing, but it does not help them. Their true progress.
Right. One aspect of a charter schools that people seem to be concerned with, some people, especially in minority communities, one aspect is that charter schools somehow tend to facilitate resegregation. Is that something that you see emerging in Indiana, or is a possibility of how people will use charter schools?
Well, I have to admit that there is some tendency toward that, because charter schools were really kind of started because people saw minority students not getting the type of education they felt they should. That was one of the things. I mean, the KIPP school, when it was started for children in Houston who were Hispanic primarily and black. I mean, that's who they really, most of them are in urban settings. That's where you're going to find minority students. So there is, I guess that is a possibility. I do know, having worked with special services at Indiana University, we started out, we were just dealing with minority students primarily. Then we looked at the students with disabilities, and we said, well, they need this too. You know, they're having to. And then we even later on, the Upward Bound program in particular, started looking at children who live in isolation areas on farms and, you know, in the rural communities. These children also are receiving less stimulation because they are so isolated. So, we need to look at all children. I mean,
well, I know one of the things that you and I have spoken about before is that when we think sometimes about where are some schools that are failing to meet different standards, and we think about urban schools, maybe schools that might be in Indy, I'm not sure, in Gary, some different places. We think that these urban schools are the ones that are having problems. But you and I, we spoke about it, that there's poverty in these rural areas as well. There's poverty in Greene County and Brown County.
And the other thing is, we very conveniently overlook the schools in urban areas that are extremely successful, and they are. Chicago has some horrible schools, but Chicago has some wonderful schools that are in primarily minority areas, you know, but they have some wonderful schools, wonderful programs. And so we don't really look at that. I don't know. I'm not an administrator in that regard. I have worked in administration, but always with students. That was always my focus. So I haven't done the kind of planning and, you know, developing of school programs, but I could. I mean, not now, I couldn't. I'm too old. But there was a time when I could have looked at developing programs, and I would have liked to have done that, but nobody ever really encouraged you to do it. You know, somebody else is doing that. And I think there are some ways that we could have improved our curricula, and probably I think some of the things that teachers could suggest, we could have done some things that were really spectacular.
You know, one of the interesting things...
We don't find that the people in Indianapolis pay a lot of attention to that, though. We've had some fabulous things go on in schools. Nobody ever really looked at it, you know.
It's very interesting what you say, because there are situations at primarily majority minority schools where there are some good things coming out. But, of course, the stereotype
absolutely.
Is that the urban schools are in the worst condition.
Right. Absolutely.
One of the things that I was reading recently that I wanted to share with you and get your thoughts about is I had read the State of Education address by Tony Bennett. Not Tony Bennett, the singer, of course, but Tony Bennett, who's working with the governor. And he says in there that equal educational opportunity for all students, the civil rights issue, that this, the equal education, excuse me, let me start again. Equal educational opportunities for all students is the civil rights issue for this generation. He says that the reality has never been more evident to me than during visits to Indiana's chronically low performing schools.
I saw that, yes.
He says also that, if I can get this correct, that instead of trying to get more money for education, our new goal is to try to get more education for the money. What are your thoughts about that, about his views on?
Well, that's a good question. Good question. And I would like to be kind to Mr. Bennett. I think he's sincere, but I saw some comments he made that kind of rankled my nerves and sounded very late 50s to me. I mean, I think in some instances we look like we're going backwards in the way we're stating things. There was this, I'm looking at his, I have his speech here too. And there was a statement he made. I said, ooh, I wonder if he really meant to say that. Sounded like all the schools that were in the inner city or in the urban areas were low achieving. Oh, I know what it was. And that that's where the poor teachers were found. You didn't find good teachers there. That is absolutely incorrect. And I don't say that because I taught in one. It was years ago when I did. But, ooh, some of these teachers and some of these schools here, they are awesome. I wouldn't argue with them or talk about what goes on and needs to go on in the classroom. I wouldn't even have an opinion because they are so up to date on everything that's going on, and they know that curriculum for the elementary and intermediate school. They are just absolutely fabulous. But we face a lot of other situations in those schools that have nothing to do with whether you can read or whatever. It's just poverty, no jobs, fathers not in the home, single parents, all those kinds of things that just impact a child's ability. Oh, I remember, you know, we have two academies here, a boys' academy and a girls'. And I was talking to a young man who worked at the boys' academy. And, you know, now our children all wear uniforms, white and blue, or blue and this, or whatever, different colors. And that's what I think they wore, white and blue, white with blue pants or something like that. And he said this child came into the office, and you could see he was sick. He was just sick and cold and just looking feverish and everything. So they let him sit in the office for a moment, and they spoke to the dean or whatever he was, spoke to the principal, and said, oh, we need to get him home. So they called the home. Of course, there was nobody there to come pick the child up, so the dean took him home. He lived in one of the projects, and so he knocked at the door. I mean, this kind of thing really tears me up, because I tell you, I cannot stand it when I see kids that, ooh, are not getting the service. He knocked on the door, and somebody came to the door, who knows who it was, and said, what's the matter? And so he said, well, he's sick. Okay, go on. And he just took the kid and kind of pushed him by his head. Go on in there. And, you know, didn't ask what's wrong with him. And you know, it's just, ooh, it just hurts you. How can a child be a student learning when those kinds of situations exist in the home and nobody's... Lord knows what's going on in the home, or
you know, but
when
we talk about those problems and the problems with the Indiana school system, be it in the classroom, be it in their home life, whatever the problems are, the truth of the matter is that the Indiana public school system is ranked in the lower 20% of the country.
I know, and
I'm very curious as to just sort of spelling out a little bit more based on your experience. What do you think are the reasons why the Indiana education system ranks so lowly nationally? We got to take a break now, but we're going to be back in a minute. And I'd like to go ahead and let's talk a little bit more about some of your thoughts about that based on your experience in the Indiana education system. I'm talking with Barbara Cope. My name is William Morse. I'm your host. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Interchange. Interchange is the longest running public affairs program in Bloomington area in southern Indiana. And our guest tonight is Barbara Cope. Barbara was the vice chancellor of Indiana University Northwest in Gary. She also served as the dean of students. And she's with us tonight just sharing some of her observations based on over 50 years in education in Indiana. Barbara, we at the end of the last segment, we were talking about Indiana's ranking in the lower 20%, or excuse me, lower 10% of the country in public education, and some of the reasons to deal with that for that. Just in a sort of a general way, based on your years as a teacher and your years in the education system, public education system, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, you're right about that. That makes me shiver every time I think about it. I once heard someone say that I think Indiana was, and this is a nasty thing for me to say, so please forgive me, but that I think Indiana was one step above Mississippi, which is a mean thing to say for Mississippi, but we do know Mississippi has difficulties in, you know, the rating of their educational system also.
Well, I'm being kind tonight when I give the statistics. Actually, the statistics that I pulled off the internet right before I came to the show was that in some ways Indiana ranks 47th in public education.
47th. Wow. Well, I can say one thing. I don't think that Gary causes it to rank 47.
Okay.
I say that 100%, and I believe that 100%. Now, I have to admit, I'm not in the Gary Community Schools now, but I know so many of the people who are, and even though what you see and what you hear may seem unbelievable sometimes, how can they be doing this? You have to remember, when I started teaching here, there were 47,000 children in the Gary schools.
How many?
47,000.
Wow. Wow. You don't think of Gary as being that big?
It was. It's not now. Now, Westside High School, in their top years, had almost that many children graduate. I mean, not that many, but they had a huge number of children graduating, huge graduating classes. But people have left. People, everything that we have done in Gary just about has really encouraged people not to stay here and not to stay with the school system. I mean, we just don't do things that keep them here. And I know that there are people who are very unhappy with with things that happen to their children in school. I can't tell you why that goes on, except that everybody. I had a secretary once, and when people would get mad at me, she always stuck up for me. I love secretaries because they always took care of me. And she would say, "You know, Ms. Cope, everybody has to report to someone. Everybody is accountable to someone if it's nobody but God." And that's true. People, when you see things that are not right, then somebody's supposed to step in there and make it right.
Well, that's interesting, that comment. Everybody has to report to someone.
To somebody.
But I wonder what happens when we're trying to educate children who have problems, as you said before, whether they be family problems, whether they're in a single household, or they don't have enough money, or there's not enough jobs, or the children are, whatever it is that's attacking the attention span and the learning capability of
that's
children,
right.
I wonder what can we do to improve that?
Well, we can find out what that real, okay, at Indiana University Northwestern, I don't mean this was all something I did, but I did oversee this program. I had a program that we considered a web, a seamless web, so that every student at Indiana University Northwest could find some way to continue his education no matter what happened to him. There was some way we could help him if he or she would work with us. In other words, if he was even dismissed, we had a program to keep a student from being dismissed that first time that it happened. We had a program. They had to sign up for it. They had to get into it. They had to participate. And we tried to fix that problem they were having that caused them to get dismissed. So that's what I see is a lack of, you know, looking at all these problems. I once had a child that a parent was being physically abused. And I was a counselor at this time. And I decided, okay, this is not going to happen to this child again. She's the sweetest thing you ever saw in your life. And so I said, I'm calling somebody downtown. And I did. I called someone and got in the biggest trouble I've ever been in my life. But I called them. This woman came out from the welfare department or someplace, and she said, "Ms. Cope, okay, if you really want to go through this, we'll go through it. But I'm going to tell you right now, she's going to have to sit in a courtroom with her mother and father and tell them what she did. Do you think she can do that?"
Well, what happened?
She didn't. I talked to her. I said, "You know, you're going to have to sit in that courtroom. You're going to have to point at your mommy and tell what she did. Can you do it?" She says, "No." And she was right. She couldn't do it because she would have died. I mean, they were. What do you do? I don't know. We have social problems.
Yes, that's what I was getting ready to say.
Interfere with the education, you know.
And how do we attack those social problems?
They need to be attacked. They do. We need to stop just painting over them like they're not there. They're there. Horrible things that we need to be paying attention to. And we wonder why our kids are, you know, doing antisocial things.
Barbara, you know, another thing, because we're coming to the end of our hour. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, you know, your affiliation has been with historically and professionally has been with Indiana University Northwest, one of the branches of Indiana University. And it's very interesting. Those of us here at WFHB and in the WFHB listening area, of course, we're based in Bloomington and we really focus on Southern Indiana. We interview folks that are associated a lot with the Bloomington campus, the so-called Anchor campus. And based on your experience at Indiana University branch, how would you kind of, you know, we're sort of changing subjects now a little bit, but you and I have had this conversation, and I think it's so interesting because here in Bloomington, we don't really think about the campus in Richmond, the campus in Gary, the campuses in different places around the state, but your career, or a lot of your career, is actually based on, or, you know, was served in IU Northwest.
And
tell us a little bit of your observations or feelings about those relationships between a branch campus and the Bloomington campus.
I'm not sure I can really talk about all branch campuses, although I would imagine there are some similarities. But so far as I am concerned, my preference would be Gary, because I know Gary, and I know so many of the needs, and I think I made an impact, not huge. I don't think I saved the world, but I think I made an impact at Indiana University Northwest for that very reason. When I first started there, there was a very low enrollment of African-American students, and there was a very bad attitude about IUN in Gary.
What was that
People
attitude?
It was a very racist, prejudiced campus. They did not like some things that went on out there. They didn't feel like the professors, some people were very, you know, open to African American. And so there was a lot to be done. Now, there was, you know, that's always two-sided. And so we did some things that I think helped. I had a wonderful staff of people, a very diverse staff, a wonderful staff. And we did a lot of things that I think helped get minority students more in the mainstream, and they run for offices, and they've done a lot of great things. I see them on the street. I see them places now, and they're telling me what they're doing. They became nurses, and they were doing all the things that they wanted to do.
How would that be different from, let's say, Indiana University in Bloomington? What would be the difference there? Because that's the question. What would be the difference between a branch campus and, let's say, the Anchor campus here in Bloomington?
I think the difference is that we honor the mature student. They don't have to be right out of college, right out of high school. I mean, we honor the mature student. The adult student that goes home and has three children there and a husband, and, you know, this is a different kind. And these people are so serious about getting, and sometimes they're having difficulty, but they're so serious about getting their degrees that it's just, mind-boggling sometimes.
So, you know, some of the literature that I found about IU, about some of the branch campuses, I think they call some of these students, these working students, mobile working students.
That's right, mobile students. And we have to make special arrangements for them. They can't always fit the mold that the student right out of high school can fit, you know.
You know, when you look at another question,
we have to make exceptions for them.
Sure.
And that was part of the thing that I talked about when I said we had a seamless web to try to catch those people when the husband, when the student, the wife comes to school. First year, everybody's happy. Second year, she's doing good, got on the dean's list. And then the husband starts getting a little nervous about, what is she doing? Why is she so happy about school and not about coming home and fixing my dinner? Oh, we've lost a lot of, you know, a lot of divorces come out of that, too.
You know, it's interesting.
So,
yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Little problems that spring up that you have to be prepared for and help. I could write a book, but I just don't have the energy.
You know, one of the things we had talked about, the effect of poverty and family and socioeconomic problems on one's ability to get an education.
Yeah.
And, you know, you and I have talked about that when we look at the spiraling cost of a college education. For example, Indiana University of Bloomington costs for an in-state student costs upwards of $10,000 per year.
And that's right. And then you hear them talk about, they prefer out-of-state students. I mean, they're not even trying to, I don't want to say that, but they made a statement earlier on this year that they were really going to put a preference on out-of-state students.
Well, I think when you see the development, and this is a good thing, I suppose, when you see the development of Ivy Tech and the development of community college system, it would make you think, and talking with here in Bloomington, talking with people who came to IU in the 60s and early 70s, they would say, well, one thing you notice nowadays is that there are less Indiana residents at IU Bloomington.
And I guess in a way that's expected and good, because that's what a high-class university does, and that's what we want to think of Bloomington as one of the, a top 10, one of the 10. And so it should be, I guess, looked upon as an institution that welcomes international and national students.
That has, I guess, a global perspective.
Right, a global perspective would be a good
one. One other thing that you and I talked about, and I'm sort of jumping around on you, but I want to get in as many of the topics that we talked about into our interview before we finish. We've got about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
One of the things you talked about, and you mentioned it tonight at the beginning of our time, you talked about how when you first started teaching in Gary, they had this program called Work, Study, and Play. And they emphasized theater, they emphasized sports, they emphasized music, and all of these different kinds of extracurricular activities. And it's very interesting now because of the things that are being cut in school budgets around the state, those are the very programs.
Those are the things that they're cutting.
Yes,
and those
exactly.
Those are the things that really help students decide, well, I want to stay. When they have to make a choice, well, I could get a job or whatever, I could stay. That will keep a student, the music that he gets to do, or, you know, arts or sports, those are things that help students stay in school. But those are things that we cut first.
You know, you had mentioned to me, I thought this was so interesting. I think the listeners will find this interesting, too. When you started teaching back in the 50s, this was when the Russians sent Sputnik up into space.
Yes.
you and I had a very amusing conversation when you talked about how Sputnik changed the school system in Gary.
That's right. And I want to say this to you, although I didn't say it then. This is my own deduction. No one ever told me this. But from talking to some other people in other areas about what happened, I came to the conclusion, Sputnik, we could not believe that the Russians beat us to something. The United States just could not believe it. You know, that was the biggest shock that ever came to them. And so immediately they grabbed it as, what can we do? And they immediately started thinking, we've got to start making more of our students who are good and apt in science and math. We've got to start doing different things with them, and that's what they did. They started testing every student and started placing them in classes according to their ability to pass tests in English, in math, and in science. And here's the thing. it didn't work. There is some place, I wish I could find this, and if you ever hear, you're down there in the big old university, maybe you can find this. There, a gentleman in Michigan, when I was up there, told me that there was a research done. They wanted to see what happened to those kids that started in sixth grade. They started taking algebra and, you know, the math, and then they also took a foreign language, and they did all these things with those children. What happened to them?
And when did they start that program?
Nothing. They went into the arts. They became a rock and roll band. They did all the things that had nothing to do with math and science, and they did not do what the people thought that they were going to do, that is become scientists and make a bigger bomb and kill more people.
There was a time then when getting a general arts education, a well-rounded arts education, was really at a premium.
Yeah.
And it seems like that
and,
has...
And see, every child in the... When I was teaching, started teaching here, our junior high school had a wonderful band, had a uniform, and they, you know... Now these little children, they have black pants and maybe a white shirt. That's their uniform. And half the time, the kid can't find black shoes or whatever it is. And so they don't even have, some of them don't even have, you know, a uniform. And it's so sad. You know, it's just so depressing.
It reminds me, Barbara.
Trying to do it, and it's hard.
Right.
Yeah.
And it reminds me, and on this note, just your last thought, we got to get ready to move on. It reminds me of something that someone said that, you know, at the end of Dr. King's life, Dr. King was not necessarily fighting race, though he still was, but he was fighting poverty.
Right. His next step, if you remember, he already had organized to get the garbage, the people who collect the garbage in Tennessee or wherever it was, he was getting ready to organize them.
Right.
Because they needed his support. And that was his next big battle that he was with, and it didn't happen.
Yeah.
So, you're right. Nobody took that one up, though.
Well, Barbara, it's been great having you with us tonight. Thank you so much for your time. Hopefully we can get you on Interchange again one day.
Thank you so much. I would enjoy doing that.
Thanks to our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by William Morse. The executive producer is January Jones. Original theme music is by Jamil Effiam. Stay tuned for Stardust with Brother Tillman, coming right up on your community radio station, WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.